Our guest today is Michael Jasny. He's Director of Marine Mammal Protection for the Natural Resources Defense Council, and we're talking about the film Sonic Sea, which screened on the Discovery Channel and Animal Planet. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good to be here. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
This is a film about the effect of human beings on the lives of ocean mammals, specifically through the sounds that we humans make in the oceans. It seems that vision, what vision is to us people, sound is to ocean mammals. How does that work? What does that look like?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the most important thing for people to know about the subject, and it's quite a leap to take, is that the ocean is a world of sound, not of sight. And there's a good reason for that. If you've ever been diving, you know that it's hard to see very far. If you're in a place like Hawaii, where there aren't a lot of nutrients in the water, maybe you can see 100 feet, maybe a bit further. But that's pretty extraordinary. 100 feet, that's barely enough distance for a mature blue whale to see its own tail flukes in the water.
Right.
So it's hardly enough space for whales and indeed many other marine animals to live in. Sound, on the other hand, is their lifeblood.
Sound travels such long distances in water, and there were some amazing details in the film about how long-distance communication works, for example, between whales, but also a scientist listening to a whale on one continent can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
What is it, 1,000 miles away?
Oh, yeah, a bit more than that. I think the example used in the film involved biologists listening to a whale off the coast of Ireland while they were located off the coast of Virginia.
Yeah. It's amazing. And so talk about that. I mean, how do they use them? What are they listening to, listening for, communicating about?
Well, for that long-distance communication, they're listening for other whales of the same species. Blue whales and fin whales are somewhat nomadic. They don't have, we think, the kind of very well-established breeding ground, say, that some other whales have. And they've evolved to keep in touch with one another by using very low-frequency sounds that travel extraordinary distances underwater. And another example in the film that I think I give is of a trial that was done back in the early 1990s, put a not even particularly loud device down in the southern Indian Ocean. And the sound produced from that device traveled up the Pacific Basin, up the Atlantic Basin, all the way to a hydrophone or underwater microphone situated off the coast of Washington State. And it was still audible when that signal arrived. It's quite amazing. And whales have evolved to take advantage of that. The problem with ocean noise, or one of its many problems, is that we're interfering with that telephone line. We're making it impossible for whales and other species to hear one another at the distances that they require to find mates and do virtually everything else they need to do to survive.
It reminded me a little bit of I saw a film once in which they were talking about a kind of bird, a small songbird, that lived in a city that found like nesting places in the city, and it had actually started to do its mating calls at night because the city was so loud during the day that they couldn't hear each other's mating calls. But in the ocean, the noise that we human beings are putting into the ocean is 24/7, 365
yeah.
days a year.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the city that never sleeps. We're urbanizing the entirety of the ocean. Certainly this is true of the northern hemisphere, where much of our shipping activity takes place. And the noise from all those ships has just raised background levels of noise in the ocean round the clock very significantly since the advent of the propeller engine. I mean, we're talking about orders of magnitude greater even in the open ocean.
Talk about that evolution. I mean, shipping has been going on since the beginning of human civilization, pretty much. What kinds, and I mean, what is the history of this kind of noise increase from our shipping on the ocean?
Well, with the advent of the propeller engine, we started to put much greater amounts of noise in the ocean than we had when we were under sail. The noise from a typical oil tanker or container ship might run about 190 decibels, to put it simply. And that is much louder than anything we were putting in the water before we really began to mechanize our ships. The other thing that's happened is that international trade has expanded enormously. I mean, there's been a virtual doubling in gross tonnage of commercial container and cargo ships just in the last 15 years alone, and despite the economic downturn of the credit crunch. So the number of ships on the water is increasing. The length of ships, size of ships on the water is increasing. And the amount of noise we're putting into the water is increasing. There's been some studies using some Navy assets that have been in the water for decades that show that noise in the low frequencies that a lot of whales use and that unfortunately ship noise occupies has doubled every decade since the earliest that we have data for, which is the late 50s, early 1960s.
One of the speakers in your film called these ships skyscrapers turned on their side with an engine.
Yeah.
I've never seen one. I mean, they're I guess unfathomably huge.
They are big, and some of the new ships that have been designed to get specifically for the Panama Canal expansion are even bigger. And these ships can be, oh gosh, I mean, you know, more than 400 meters in length. You know, we're talking multiple football fields laid end to end. And you can imagine the kind of power that's needed to move these things. A single ship, just in the course of a given day, can burn up about $100,000 worth of fuel, and it's no exaggeration. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine the kind of energy that's being used, much of which goes directly into the water.
We're talking to Michael Jasny about the film Sonic Sea. So when whales and dolphins and porpoises and other marine mammals are exposed to sounds from shipping, what happens? How do they respond? What kind of harm occurs to them?
Yeah, it's really a great range of responses and effects. So for some distance around the ships, you see a habitat displacement or abandonment. So whales and other animals will stop what they're doing and they will leave. Some species will just suffer decrements in their ability to go about their business if they remain in the area. So, for example, marine mammals will lose some of their food. Their ability to forage will decrease, and we can measure these things by the sounds that marine mammals make when they're feeding. Some fish species have been shown to lose much of their ability to respond to predators, increasing their risk of being attacked and eaten, even down to invertebrates. Invertebrates like mollusks and brittle stars that work the sea bottom. They turn over the sediment in the sea bottom, which is important to a lot of benthic life. They've been shown to basically stop doing that. And then as you move out into even greater and greater distances, you have the kinds of problems with communications that I mentioned before. There's some whales just go silent. Even when they don't go silent, they can't hear each other.
They actually go deaf?
Do they go deaf? There's certainly indications from stranding data that whales can lose their hearing over time, and some of that, no doubt, is due to the increases in noise that humans have made. But even if they don't go deaf, they become functionally deaf. they can't hear each other at very far distances. So we're talking about, you know, blue whales and fin whales, but other whale species as well are used to and depend on hearing one another over tens and hundreds of miles. And all of a sudden, that range has shrunk to, a relatively small bubble around them. It's like try to walk around your town with a floodlight constantly in your eyes. It would be difficult to go about your business, and this is what whales are experiencing all the time. The oceanographer, Dr. Sylvia Earle, who is also featured in the film, has described ocean noise as a depth of 1,000 cuts for marine life, and that about sums it up.
Well, it'd be like you and me trying to have this interview in the middle of a Metallica concert.
Yeah, that would be unfortunate on many levels. But that's right. I mean, we're primarily visual species, and yet put in that kind of acoustic environment, we'd barely be able to function. You can imagine what it's like for species like whales and fish that are acoustic species, not primarily visual ones. It's all the more difficult for them.
The film opens with a scientist who is featured throughout the film, a former Navy officer who is now a research scientist studying marine mammals, and he talks about a day when many whales were beached on some islands in the northern Bahamas. What happened?
Yeah, so the biologist, his name is Ken Balcom, and a really remarkable man, was down in the northern Bahamas, as you say, on a March day in 2000. He had been studying populations of beaked whales in the northern Bahamas for years. And beaked whales are extraordinary even by whale standards. They are the deepest diving whales that we know of. They've recorded the deepest dives ever documented, 3,000 meters in some cases, which is just astonishing for a mammal if you think about it, going all the way from the surface and breathing air and then going 3,000 meters underwater to find food.
Yeah.
Because these guys are deep divers, and because they're pretty shy, they're hardly ever seen, but Ken Balcom, over the course of just about a decade, had come to know and identify individual members of a population of beaked whales. Well, all of a sudden, he got a call about a beaked whale quite nearby where he and his research station were, and went out to see it. He was astonished to see a beaked whale come to shore. I mean, they rarely strand. And he spent the morning just doing everything he could to lead this beaked whale back out to sea. It was very hard. He would get it going a certain distance, and it would turn back and restrand. And he and his team were in the water trying to help for hours. And they'd gotten the whale back out to sea, or so they thought, and all of a sudden they got another call about a beaked whale that had stranded some miles away. And in the course of that day, he kept getting more and more calls. He, at some point, got on a plane with a friend of his, and they were spotting beached and dying whales just over, I think, a couple hundred kilometers of beach all around the northern Bahamas. So this was really, really remarkable given the species. This is unknown to happen.
And it turned out that they had been exposed to noise that made them, come to the surface too quickly and therefore get sick and die?
Yeah, that's right. So the bodies were recovered, and some of them anyway, and were taken for something called necropsy, which is the animal equivalent of an autopsy, and the tissues were analyzed, and it was clear that there was some terrible trauma that all of these whales had experienced. They had bleeding around the brain and around the ears, lesions in organ tissue, like the liver, damage to something called the acoustic sats, which are it's tissue that conducts sound to the ear and through the jaw as well of the species. And all of these symptoms, all these pathologies, were consistent with decompression sickness or the bends. As I'm sure you know, your listeners know, when humans dive, you know, we have to leave the water gradually. We have to ascend gradually, or we can get a buildup of nitrogen in the blood and in our tissue, and can suffer some serious physiological damage. And yeah. That's what seems to have happened to those whales.
There's something that I think, at least that's what I got from the film, happens when you are a researcher of these kinds of animals. You develop a kind of love for them and relationship with them. And one of the people in the film was talking about how whales and dolphins and all other marine mammals are not only highly intelligent and conscious, they're also gracious. That was a word that was used. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could describe your experience of their grace.
Sure. Maybe I can try to do it by remaining in the Bahamas to talk a little bit about Ken Balcom. Mm-hmm. Because Ken Balcom, as you mentioned, is a marine biologist, but he also spent much of his life working for the Navy. And he had a real love for the Navy still. You could say that he had a sort of a foot in both worlds. And what happened in the Bahamas, it emerged that the cause of these terrible pathologies and the death of all these whales was a Navy, U.S. Navy training exercise. The Navy was moving through the northern Bahamas, sounding a very loud sonar system aboard multiple ships, and that drove the whales into what was likely a fight-or-flight response. And they went into the shallows. They could no longer deep dive. They could no longer decompress, and they ended up severely injured and dying in the beaches of the Bahamas. Ken is someone who tried to really work with the Navy in honor, I think, of his old passions and allegiances, and in the end felt he had to go public in order to get the truth out. And I mean, this is wonderfully documented in a book that came out last year by Josh Horowitz. It's a bestseller called War of the Whales, mm-hmm. which I'd strongly recommend. And one of the things that I think it shows is the effect of what you're talking about, this graciousness, this profound sense that people have around whales in particular, how that really transformed a life in the form of Ken Balcom.
There's another moment in the film where one of the researchers was talking about being on a boat, and for some reason, in a moment, he decided to start playing his flute, and the whales came to the boat. And I wondered is there a kind of like communication that happens between people and whales through music?
Yeah, I mean it's possible. These are acoustic creatures who are very sensitive to the sounds that we make. There are a number of researchers that have been trying to see if they could use sounds as a way of establishing some form of communication with wild dolphin populations, for example, and it's not far fetched given how intelligent and I think inherently musical the marine mammals are. And that particular incident I thought was especially wonderful. There was another real ocean luminary featured in the film, Jean-Michel Cousteau, who reflects on what's changed since his father, Jean-Jacques Cousteau, produced the film The Silent World about the ocean back in the 1950s. And he said, it's the difference is it's gotten a lot louder since then, and it's not exactly music that we're making.
Well, it's an ironic title for two reasons. One is that the noise we've put into the ocean means that it no longer is a silent world, but it also never was. I mean, the recordings
Right.
that you scientists have done in the interim has been fantastic. And I don't know to what extent you have decoded or come to understand at least some of the language that's going on underneath the sea, but it's extensive and it's really complex.
Yeah, no, that's right. If you ever listen to killer whales, killer whale pods vocalizing, and here we're talking about resident killer whales. They tend to be fish-eating species, and rather than whales that predate on other marine mammals, these tend to be the really vocal ones. It can start sounding like humans or human communities. There's one clip that I remember hearing of a mom and her two calves, and it sounds all the world to me like the mom is calling on one of her calves who's just sort of poking around and exploring things, and she's kind of urging him to come on. Yeah, come on, come on. And he's saying, oh, just wait a second, Mom. You become convinced that these conversations are going on. And obviously some of that is anthropomorphism, but given the complexity of the signals that they use, one can have little doubt that there is a lot of complex and sophisticated information being transferred from one to the other. But that's the world that these species live in, and it's the world that we're corrupting.
I've been reading a book by the primatologist Frans de Waal called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And
yeah.
It's really interesting because he has a different take on anthropomorphism, namely that we share so much that
yeah.
anthropomorphism isn't far-fetched or isn't necessarily incorrect. I mean, we recognize things in non-human animals all the time.
Right. Yeah, I think that's an extremely important point. There's a fallacy that people desperately try to avoid in the biological sciences called anthropomorphism, and I think that's been a bit of an overreaction, and it's inhibited, I think, very reasonable scientific investigation. I mean, you just take fight or flight or stress response, and these are actions that are highly conserved across mammalian species. I mean, you see it in everything from mice to whales, and not to mention humans. And it's only, I think, fairly recently that people have broken down the anthropomorphism barrier and have been willing to entertain, from a marine mammal perspective, that these species have some of the same stress response that we have. I think there needs to be, in the biological sciences, a bit of a turn and a move toward a happier medium.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Charles Darwin wrote about animal emotion, and then it sort of went away
yeah.
for a while and now seems to be coming back. And particularly where these marine mammals are concerned, it seems like, as you were saying, and as the people who work with them feel very intuitively, even as they're studying them as scientists, a kind of kinship, connection, and communication
yeah.
with these animals.
Yeah, I think there are multiple experiences that people have simultaneously when they encounter whales, whether it's for the first or the 100th time, that can account for the profundity of the experience. And one of those things is the sense of awe that people have around a great whale. It accounts, I think, a bit for the graciousness of which you spoke, a sense of grace in encountering a creature that is just incommensurately larger than yourself, and nonetheless, recognizes you and moves itself in the water so as to avoid harming you. At the same time, I think that increasingly in recognition of emotion in other species, we are finally beginning to experience empathy for other species as not entirely unlike ourselves. And that combination of feeling at once this sense of great awe before, you know, a much larger animal, and at the same time, the feeling we have of empathy, of an animal capable of emotion and cognition, just as we are when we encounter it, it can make for just a profoundly moving experience. And there's a moment in the film that I think reflects this well, where a few of the biologists we feature in the film describe their first memorable encounter with whales, and they're all touched with the kind of awe and disbelief you see in little kids. And these are senior biologists in most cases that you see, you know, breaking down into something sweet and fundamentally human.
We're talking to Michael Jasny about the film Sonic Sea, which is about all the noise that we make in the oceans and how marine mammals, and as you say, not only marine mammals, I mean marine reptiles and fish and crustaceans and all kinds of creatures responding to these noises. And there's this amazing moment when scientists were able to correlate a precipitous decrease in the stress hormone level of whales, which they were testing, with the slowdown of shipping that happened right after September 11th, 2001. It seems that our disaster was their relief.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really one of the more remarkable studies I've ever read. There are researchers, mainly from the New England Aquarium, who were out getting fecal samples on North Atlantic right whales. And the right whale, North Atlantic right whale, is both an iconic and a critically endangered species. They were decimated by whaling. There are only about 500 left in the world. They're not recovering. And one of the reasons it's been postulated they're not recovering is all the noise that has really transformed their East Coast habitat. One biologist calls them essentially an urbanized whale. So these biologists had been going out and getting fecal samples to study their stress levels in right whales, which can be a marker of health. And what they saw was that in the fall of 2001, after 9/11, the stress markers in their fecal samples started going down and down very, very significantly. The next year, they were right back up again. The only time they saw this decrease was in 2001, over the many years they ran the study. And that decrease really did seem to turn around the date of 9/11. After 9/11, ship traffic in the right whale habitat off the Northeast all but stopped. It was a one change they could identify in the whale's environment that could possibly account for the decrease in stress. One of the people interviewed in the film describing this research says, you know, it finds it shocking because this change in stress level is so measurable. The danger, of course, is that, as we all know, chronic stress over time produces serious effects in health. Reproductive failure, immunosuppression, and greater vulnerability to disease, and so on. So, stressing out an endangered species, in addition to every other effect that noise has on right whales, could very well be playing a significant role in their failing to recover.
This whole question of what happened after 9/11 and the stress hormone levels of whales went down, and we won't get into the details of how people collect whale fecal samples, although
they use dogs.
It did make me wonder. But it does set up, I mean, this conflict between what humans do for our own economic benefit, for national security, for oil and gas exploration, which we haven't even talked about yet. It seems that the things we do to enrich ourselves are in direct contrast to what these creatures need. And when we have you know, if we were to have, for example, a huge population decrease or a huge economic depression, those animals would benefit. I mean, is there a way that we continue to do our thing, but let them do their thing too? Or are we just like in opposed to each other's interests?
Yeah, I mean, I have two thoughts about that. The first is that in some ways, the issue of ocean noise is aligned with the issue of climate change, that many of the things that we do that is increasing global warming is also increasing noise in the ocean. And conversely, many of the things that we can do collectively or as individuals to reduce our carbon footprint can also make life a bit easier for whales and fish and other ocean species. So, you know, for example, shipping is of course a huge piece of this problem. We ship well over 95% of the goods that we consume. To the extent that we, you know, increase local consumption instead of, say, you know, buying those grapes from Chile, instead buying things from farms that are closer to where we live, you know, we're improving the situation. Oil and gas exploration is another big part of the problem. Oil and gas companies prospect for oil offshore by putting enormous amounts of sound into the water. It's like an explosion going off roughly every 10 seconds or so for months on end.
Oh, God, it's heartbreaking when you see that part in the film.
Yeah, oh, yeah, and it's been associated with, this activity has been associated with certainly impacts on marine mammals over very large areas of ocean, but also to impacts on fish, just dramatic declines in catch rates and fisheries. So it's affecting humans directly as well. But to the extent that we are using renewable energy and not relying on fossil fuels, and which portfolio we find offshore oil and gas, you know, we're making things a bit better. And so the thinking that a lot of people have had, a message people are putting out to individuals, well, you know, think about one thing that you can do to reduce your carbon footprint. It's also likely to reduce your noise footprint. So it's something else to think about as another thing to inspire you to make these environmental improvements in your life. The second thought I have is that ocean noise is a fixable problem. It's a lot less intractable, say, than ocean-borne toxics or mercury deposition or climate change. And the reason for that is pretty simple. You know, once you stop making noise, it goes away. It's gone. Even though it travels far in the ocean, it's still going to be gone within a matter of minutes, or, you know, less than an hour.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It's not something you have to clean up the way you have to clean up a spill.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, you just have to stop doing the activity,
yeah.
and that's effectively also your cleanup. So if there are ways to reduce noise at the source, for example, so that we're putting less sound in the water as we ship goods or explore for oil or construct wind turbines and other things offshore, then, you know, we can actually make real strides in addressing the problem. And indeed, there are solutions. Just to rattle off a couple of examples, for shipping, navies and researchers have modified their propellers and engines for years to quiet their ships. And many of those methods are available to the commercial shipping industry as well. Oil and gas companies have been using these air guns that go off every 10 seconds for decades. I mean, they were a replacement for dynamite and for labor safety reasons, and they sound about as loud. But there are a number of technologies on the horizon. There's actually one that's available now that can significantly reduce the sound that these prospecting ships make. In order to get us from here to there, from where we are now to a world where the shipping industry and the oil and gas industry and navies and offshore construction, where they're reducing their environmental footprint, that takes political will. It takes people demanding change, and that's not only change from government, but it's change from companies as well.
Right. Although it probably requires some regulation and some rules, does it not?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of the problem has been that our federal agencies in the United States, while they have pretty substantial regulatory authority in this area, have been fairly lax. Insofar as they've regulated the problem, they focused on impacts on marine mammals and some other species that might occur relatively close to a powerful noise source, say within a kilometer or two, say, so for example, death or permanent loss in hearing, which for acoustic animals can be the same thing as death. What they've not done is try to tame the bigger part of the problem, really, which is the long-distance, widespread, chronic noise that our activities are producing. In that sense, Europe is ahead of us. There is European Union-wide legislation that requires countries to get into good environmental status for ocean noise within a number of years. And that process is still very much underway. We have to see where things wind up. But they're making strides, and where they want to go is where we need to go.
We're talking to Michael Jasny about the film Sonic Sea. What is the role of marine mammals in ocean ecosystems, and what would it mean for us, for human beings, if we really continue to decimate their populations in large numbers?
Yeah, people often think of different elements of the ocean as providing ecosystem services. These are functions that marine mammals and other species accomplish that are necessary for the survival of ocean ecosystems. The easiest way to think about it, I think, for marine mammals is that they make up your top predators and some of the largest consumers of lower organisms in the marine environment. To remove them will have, if you can imagine, marine mammals just disappearing off the face of the earth, in that Star Trek film, the effects would just cascade across the entire trophic, or that is to say, feeding system. It's almost impossible to imagine.
But it would affect our supply of fish and things that we eat as human beings.
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly put entire chain of life in the ocean out of balance.
It seems like there are two ways that people tend to think about these issues. One is this thing that we're talking about, the human-centered view, like if we destroy ocean ecosystems, or indeed forest ecosystems, prairie ecosystems, whatever it is, that's really bad for people, and we think about ecosystem services. Another way to think about it is that these creatures have a right to live, regardless of what our needs may or may not be, or what we think they are. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think about it both ways, and I think you need to think about it in both ways. Much of the regulation that's done in the United States for noise and other things is really focused on population viability. So we're just concerned whether a species or population can be left alone enough that it can continue to survive on that large scale. And unfortunately, our laws and regulations frequently don't think of marine mammals and other species as having intrinsic value, having lives and a welfare that we ought to protect. And I think until we start thinking in those terms, thinking about how every impact that we make on a sentient creature like a whale diminishes the world, we are probably not going to save our oceans. You know, so I'm someone I think who comes from a science orientation, who has learned over time the value of respecting animals for their intrinsic worth, and hope that form of empathy, like the kind that's embodied by the film Sonic Sea, can change hearts and minds.
Are you hopeful? I mean, are these kinds of changes that seem like incremental changes, like quieter propellers on ships and alternatives like somewhat quieter Navy sonar and things like that, are they enough?
Well, you know, we won't know. You know, part of the frightening thing about what we're doing to the ocean is that we don't have a grasp of it all. We scarcely know what's going on. It's all happening beneath the waves. Whales and many other marine animals are long-lived and far-ranging and very difficult to study. And we're, you know, we think we saved the whales when we put an end to most whaling back in the 1980s. But these species are in greater danger than ever before, most of them, because they're being hit by stressors six ways to Sunday. It's the noise in the ocean, or they're being struck by ships, or they're overloaded with toxics, or they're having to grapple with changing food distributions from climate change and ocean acidification and so on and so forth. At some point, we exceed some threshold of viability, some level at which whales and other animals can no longer survive. And the really frightening thing is, we won't know when we've passed it. And that's because it is so very difficult to observe in real time, as it were, what's happening beneath the waves. I think about some old Talmudic expression about how you're not required to desist. You're not required to complete the work, but neither may you desist from it. And that's how I see at least the work that we do in marine conservation. Some of what we're striving for may not be realizable for decades. What I want to ultimately see is mandatory, prescriptive regulation of shipping noise, for example, on an international scale, mandatory code, tough mandatory code from the International Maritime Organization. I think we're going to get there. I think it is going to take a couple decades. But in the meantime, we have to do what we can, working with individual ports, working with shipping lines, raising public profile to get commitments from them to really decrease their footprint in the ocean and make the strides we can, and hopefully build up a critical mass of support for the really big overarching changes that must come.
Michael Jasny is Director of Marine Mammal Protection for the Natural Resources Defense Council. The film is called Sonic Sea. It screens on the Discovery Channel and Animal Planet. You can find out more information at sonicsea.org. Are there any other ways that people can see the film, like if they don't have cable?
There are a few things, a few ways to go about it. One way is to just have a look at our website, sonicsea.org, as you mentioned. There is a page of screenings that are taking place around the U.S. and Europe and Canada as well. If there isn't a screening near you, there is a place on the website you can go to sign up to organize a screening, and it can be as small or large as you want. Eventually, one piece of good news is that the film will shortly have an educational distributor, and so we hope to get it into colleges and even high schools. And ultimately, it will probably be available for web streaming as well, and by DVD too. So I would suggest going to sonicsea.org and seeing what's showing near you.
It's a wonderful film, and I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we've got a few minutes left, so we're going to go out with some music from Paul Winter, Lullaby from the Great Mother Whale, in which you will hear actual songs of whales. Thanks for listening to the Radio Cafe today. Thank you.